Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. When too many people share a single resource, sometimes they overuse it. And overgrazing or overfishing might be a couple of examples. And that is something that is sometimes referred to as the tragedy of the commons. Now, one of the solutions that has been proposed for the tragedy of the commons is to create private property, because when people own something, they tend to be more careful about how they use that resource. However, if there are too many owners, each one may indeed be in a position to block the others from using that resource, and then nobody can use it. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus, Michael Heller, has coined a phrase for that, and he calls that the tragedy of the anti-commons. We'll talk about that this morning in this hour of Focus 580 as we talk with Michael Heller about his book, The Gridlock Economy. The subtitle is How Too Much Ownership Wrecks Markets, Stops Innovation, and Costs Lives. The book is published by Basic Books. Our guest, Michael Heller, is one of the country's leading authorities on property. He is professor of real estate law at Columbia Law School and has also served as the school's vice dean for intellectual life. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of people is that they try to keep their comments brief when they call in. But, of course, you're welcome to call and make comments, ask questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So whichever one works for you, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, or anywhere around Illinois, Indiana, where the signal will travel, indeed across the country if you would happen to be listening on the Internet. You may also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. Professor Heller, hello.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks very much for talking to us.
It's great to be here.
Just right off here at the beginning, why don't I ask you to give an example or two of what it is that you're talking about?
Well, what I've discovered is a new form of congestion. We're all familiar with traffic congestion. Everyone can see a traffic jam. But what's hidden and what's new are ownership jams. Which I'm calling tragedies of the anti-commons. So let me give you a life or death example that's happening right now. I was talking with a drug company executive, and he tells me that he thinks he has a better Alzheimer's treatment, which could save millions of lives. But he can't bring it to market because he can't assemble all of the he can't license all of the individual patents that he needs that are owned by different biotech companies. Any single one of those patent holders can hold them up for a huge payoff or block the whole deal. And that's what's happened. So he's shelved his cure, even though he's pretty sure it could save millions of lives and earn him billions of dollars. So that's one life or death example of too many owners. Drugs that should exist, that could exist, aren't being created. And it's not just drugs that are missing. We're suffering, our economy is now suffering gridlock across the entire wealth creation and innovation frontier. Mm-hmm.
And you obviously, in the book, you give a number of different examples, and perhaps we'll talk about some of those. And I think when you give those examples, and people hear that, and I hear it, I say, well, I see the point. That makes sense. I understand how that is a problem. And yet at the same time, the basic idea, when I first picked up the book and started looking at it, and I imagine other people had this reaction too, I felt I had an almost sort of a gut-level reaction and saying, well, wait a minute, no. Private property is good, and it seems like that it's unreservedly good, and I'm thinking, well, now, is this guy making an attack on the very notion of private property?
Not at all. I am a pro-free market guy, and this book comes at the problem from a pro-free market perspective. Usually, private ownership creates wealth. That's why it's such a great solution to the problems that you raised in the introduction of overuse of resources, pollution, and depleting the fisheries. You create private property because you get people to conserve and to get rich, and you align their incentives through private ownership. So usually private ownership is a great thing, but what people hadn't noticed, what's a glitch in the free market, what I discovered is this problem of the possibility of having sometimes too many owners. And that isn't an anti-private property position at all. It's saying we have to figure out ways within a private property system to make it easier and more both more fair and more efficient for people to be able to assemble resources for positive change. So in the new economy today, more and more kinds of innovation require assembly of privately owned resources, like assembly of all those patents to create a new drug. So it's not that I'm against patents, just the opposite. Patents spur discovery and invention. But we need a way to assemble those patents so we can get to, so we as a society can benefit from the larger benefits of private ownership. In the drug case, drugs that will save our lives.
And this is, I think you just made the point that I wanted to get at too, is that while one can find examples of the problem of the anti-commons, you even have one that goes back to the Middle Ages, it seems that it is something that has become more critical with the economy in which we find ourselves now.
Oh, absolutely. This is the problem of too many owners and gridlock and the cost that arise from that is a problem that goes back as far as we have recorded history in very isolated circumstances. But today, in the last 10, 20 years, we've seen a radical shift in the way innovation works in America. And it's mostly been a hidden shift. And the costs of gridlock have been rising and rising and rising. And part of them, probably they're costs that we don't realize. We all understand that the mortgage system is broken. We understand that our cell phones don't work so well in this country by comparison with abroad. We understand that we're not seeing a bunch of big breakthroughs in the drug context. So we understand that something's gone wrong, that our economy's in a slump, but we don't know why. And what this book explains is a paradox of the free market that shows you why in a modern economy, in a high-tech economy, the problem of fragmented ownership of too many owners of pieces of the same resource leads to cooperation breaking down, wealth disappearing, and everybody losing.
Well, I'm sure that one of the arguments that people raise is that the importance of things like patents and copyrights, other kinds of rights issues, or land ownership, or whatever, is that it is pro-competitive in the sense that what it does is it makes it more difficult for any individual or group of individuals or company or group of companies to dominate some particular sphere. So what we're talking about here is this is one of the things that prevents the formation of monopolies or the dominance of, say, one company in computers, software, pharmaceuticals, chemical products, you know, whatever it is that you're talking about.
Absolutely. So what one way to think about the problem of gridlock is to keep on the one hand the problem that you just raised, the problem of fostering competition. So usually the goal in terms of fostering competition is to have robust markets, to have creative energy leading to creation of new products and new wealth. So normally when you have, for example, a commons, like you discussed at the very beginning, where anyone can take fish out of the ocean, you don't get that kind of productivity. You get the resource being destroyed. So usually, antitrust, that is keeping people apart, keeping lots of different producers, is a very valuable way to create wealth. But sometimes, and this is a discovery, sometimes pro-trust is the wealth-creating, pro-competitive solution. So we certainly don't want one company, but if you want to get new life-saving drugs, to stick with that first example, you need to have it be possible for drug makers that actually produce the pills in the bottle to have some fair and efficient way to collect the patents they need in order to create those new products. Mm. Or else you have a lot of small pieces of the puzzle, patents that don't do very much, sitting around helping nobody. So sometimes the ownership system just gets it wrong. Patents are just a creation of Congress, and they change it from year to year. The current patent system was last overhauled in 1952, before we discovered DNA, before we had the Internet. So we have in place today a patent system that was designed and created for a certain style of innovation 50 years ago that no longer works for innovation today. We need a new, again, to stick with patents, but this is the same is true for land and copyrights and other forms of ownership. We need a new form of ownership that makes it possible fairly and efficiently to put resources together.
Is this particularly an American problem?
Well, in the book, I focus on American examples. So I talk about rap music and airport delays, things that every one of us is familiar with in America. But no, this is a problem that is all over the world. So, for example, in the United States, our cell phones are way behind the global standard. So that's an American problem. But there are other areas where other countries fall behind the United States. So in the book, I mostly focus on American examples, but anywhere that you have ownership, which is everywhere, you can have the problem of too much ownership leading to gridlock.
Our guest in this first hour of Focus 580 today, Michael Heller. He is professor of law at Columbia Law School. He's a professor of real estate law and is one of the leading authorities in the country on property. He is the author of the book, The Gridlock Economy, the subtitle, How Too Much Ownership Wrecks Markets, Stops Innovation, and Costs Lives. It's published by Basic Books, so if you'd like to read the book, you can go out and seek it out. And, of course, here on the program, questions are welcome to 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here getting lined up, and we'll start. We'll talk with someone in Effingham. This is line four. Hello.
Yes, I would like to introduce into this conversation I think what your guest is aiming at. The society is torn between what it needs and what it thinks it needs. Thomas Jefferson, you know, with his 40 acres and a mule, was the paradigm of the early sedentary peoples. But in modern times, I don't think there's any solution to the problems that humanity is facing, except we have to accept some Marxism into the process. I mean, it always takes revolution to turn those things over, whether it's quiet or whether it is belligerent. And if we don't think in those terms and think of the free market as now worn out, I mean, just as your guest is saying, there's too few owners and too many others, you know, on the periphery who are excluded. And then that is nuanced by the capitalist paradigm that continues to age and to become worn out. But my perspective is that of, I'll refer to Frederick Engels, The Origin of Private Property, The Family, and The State. And then all three of those things then introduced into human society and now has become destructive. Here on the phone.
Let us get a response from the guest.
Well, thank you for the guest from Effingham. I first discovered, let me back up. I actually am very skeptical of any sort of Marxist solution to this problem, the problem of gridlock. And that's in part because I first discovered gridlock. First saw it in its absolutely worst forms when I was working for the World Bank in the early 90s in the Soviet Union. When it was still the Soviet Union, the leaders of that country called the bank in and said, if we were going to create markets, what do we do? So I was part of that first group that went in and addressed the Moscow Soviet. There was billowing red bunting behind me, a big statue of Lenin, and we talked about how do you create property rights in land and private property rights in land and housing. But what we saw in Russia was the worst forms of gridlock was resources that were completely wasted, completely unused. The most basic resources like land and housing and food that simply weren't available at all, because they had fragmented ownership in ways that would be inconceivable in a market system. So, yes, the market system is a terribly flawed system, and I couldn't agree with your caller more on that point. It is a terribly flawed system until you begin to look around the world at the alternatives that you actually have in place. So my perspective is much more of one of a critic of the free market system, but of a sympathetic critic, of saying, what can we do to fix the problems rather than destroy the system? And that's really, if there's one point for this book, mostly it's a fun read, I hope, but if there's one serious point for the book, it's to make visible the problem of too much ownership, a problem that tends to be invisible, and by making it visible, to harness the energy of your listeners and of citizens and of politicians and of industry, to harness our energy to begin working together to fix these problems, because I think they are fixable. Your caller mentioned one other point that I wanted to respond to, which was he mentioned Thomas Jefferson, one of our first presidents. Thomas Jefferson was actually a gridlock hero. In 1808, under his Secretary of the Treasury, Gallatin, he created the first plan for how to overcome gridlock in canals and roads in America. So to knit America together into the most powerful market in the world, they needed to overcome the little local ability to block the construction of canals. And that plan, the Gallatin Plan under Thomas Jefferson, was really the first major infrastructure plan for this country. Teddy Roosevelt did the second in 1908 that laid the basic infrastructure for the 20th century for water, for dams, for when it became the highway system, it became the energy system. What we need today, what the gridlock economy is calling for, is in 2008, 200 years after Thomas Jefferson's plan, 100 years after Teddy Roosevelt's, to have a new plan for the 21st century infrastructure that we need to overcome the gridlock today in wind power, in solar power, in cellular and wireless, and all the different forms of infrastructure that this economy needs going forward in this century.
Hmm. Well, for example, you take the example of building a canal or building a road or maybe building an airport or putting more runways in an existing airport. You have this problem. A number of owners own the land, and what are you going to do to get the land? If one alternative, I suppose, would simply be something like public domain
that says people hate that.
Yeah, exactly. You can't. Right. You really can't have government coming in and saying, "Well, for the public good, we're going to take your land, and if you're lucky, we're going to give you something for it." So, what is the alternative between that and then having to negotiate these individual, perhaps prohibitively costly deals with each and every small owner?
Right. Well, this is an area where the United States turns out to be behind the rest of the world. In the U.S., we really only have two ways to assemble land for positive change, and one is, as you say, to voluntarily go and buy every piece, which is impossible because people won't sell for one reason or another. Grandma's buried in the backyard, or they're holding out for more money. Or the government can come in and seize it, which is eminent domain, which confiscate it, which people hate. So the result is that what we currently have in this country is the inability to create large parcels of land for any sort of really high-powered economic development. So the benefit we have is you protect a certain vision of ownership. The cost is an enormous hidden loss for all of us by not being able to have the country grow. So let me give you a concrete example, and then I'll come back to a solution. Mm-hmm. A concrete example is part of how I discovered gridlock, and that was something that every one of your listeners has faced, sitting around in airports waiting for the plane. And I wondered, why can't we build more airports in this country? So I looked into it, and it turns out we deregulated air travel in this country in 1978, 30 years ago. Since then, since the last 30 years, we've only built one new airport, one major new airport in all the United States, Denver. That's the only one. And during that time, the number of air travelers has tripled. Three times the number of travelers, one new airport. Of course there's delays. And those delays are enormously costly to all of us. But building new airports is almost impossible because of the problem of gridlock, the problem of each of the little owners saying, well, I don't want my land taken, and of our genuine and proper reluctance to have the government confiscate it. So we all lose out to protect a small number of neighbors, but we seem to have no solution. So in the book, I offer a solution. Once you see that this is the problem, once you see that the reason we're all wasting our lives in airports is because of gridlock, you can begin to look for solutions. So a solution I propose is what I call land assembly districts, LADs. The way a land assembly district works is it's more or less like a condo association, and it lets neighbors decide for themselves whether their neighborhood should be the one that's assembled for some large-scale use. So it would let rural neighborhoods decide which one is most willing to sell for a new airport, for example. So once you see the problem of gridlock, you can come up with creative new solutions, and LADs is one of them.
We have several other callers. Let's talk with them, starting with someone in Champaign. Well, no, that person changed their mind. We'll go to somebody here in Urbana, line number two.
Hello? Hi, my comment is a bit tangential, but you had mentioned that America's cell phones are way behind the world, and I wondered in what way and then what caused that.
That's a great question. The United States used to have the fastest, most capable cell phone system in the world just in the last 20 years. Today, the U.S. has fallen out of the top 10 and almost out of the top 20 in things like wireless penetration and the ability to receive and transmit high-speed data anywhere in the country. We simply don't have the kinds of high-speed networks that you see in Japan or Korea. So in the U.S., you get dropped calls all the time, and you can't, for example, watch live television on your cell phone. We simply don't have the bandwidth available to be able to do really data-intensive kinds of next-generation technology that is already the norm, the standard, in much of the advanced world. So then you ask, well, so you travel overseas and you see people in Japan or Korea or much of Europe having all sorts of technology that really is the technology that knits the economy together in use. And you come home and you say, well, why is my cell phone so terrible? And it's not the fault of the cell phone companies. It's the fault of a terrible system of ownership. So if I were to ask your caller, what is the most underused natural resource in America, the most underused natural resource, the answer might be a surprise. The answer is the airwaves. Over 90% of the airwaves in America are dead air, are completely unused. Why? Because we set up the system of ownership of or licensing of spectrum in the 1920s. We set it up at a time when we were competing with the Soviet Union, and we set it up more or less on a socialist model. So we broke it up into these very highly restricted licenses in very limited geographic areas and created thousands and thousands of these licenses, which are impossible now, today, to knit together into high-speed national wireless networks. So what we have is this another case where we have too many owners, in this case defunct pager companies or pizza delivery services that control bits of spectrum that aren't allowed to sell them and aren't allowed to use them for any modern uses. So 90% is simply dead air, which means that if you're a cell phone provider or a wireless provider or a data provider or any sort of next-generation technology and you need access to spectrum, which is available in other countries, it's simply not available in this country. You simply can't get the spectrum that you need to provide next-generation service. So the U.S. has been falling very quickly, further and further behind, because of this problem of spectrum gridlock. At the start of the show, I talked about patent gridlock costing us life-saving drugs, and that the cost of that is in the billions. Economists suggest that the cost of spectrum gridlock, the losses to the economy, the hidden losses from too much ownership, measure in the trillions of dollars.
Wow.
This is wrecking the next generation of technology in this country. Oh. And again, it's a hidden problem. Just like no one knows where to go protest for drugs that should exist but don't, people similarly don't know to protest for the kinds of technologies that should exist but don't. The problem of too many owners is usually a hidden problem. It's the resources that don't get created, the inventions that don't get made, because you have too many little owners, each blocking the other.
Well, that's incredible. You're awesome, and your knowledge is vast, and I thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
That's the best kind of comment.
Well, although I find myself going back to, again, something we talked about earlier, and this is something that people really worry about, and that is spectrum dominance by someone,
mm-hmm.
By one particular interest, one company, who then, if they got control over the spigot, then they're going to be in a position to determine who gets to use the spectrum or what kind of information gets to flow through. And the idea is that that's supposed to be completely open, and that the more concentration of ownership, and we've certainly seen it in over-the-air broadcasting,
right.
The more concentration of ownership, that's problematic.
That is a great point. So again, just like your earlier question about the sort of benefits of anti-monopoly, you have to always keep in mind and for the front of your mind what are the costs from fragmentation. So in the spectrum area, there's a very wide range of views from the left to the right on what we should do about the anti-commons tragedy, the problem of gridlock or too many owners. But everybody from the left to the right agrees that the current system, the system where 90% of the air is simply dead, makes everybody worse off. So you can imagine solutions that are increasing privatization of the airwaves, or you can imagine solutions that are increasing commons ownership of the airwaves. But any solution that puts the airwaves to work is better than the current one, which is having most of it be dead air. And to the extent that your concern specifically is with having more voices be able to be heard, the biggest breakthrough we've had in having more voices be heard is not having lots of little low-power stations around the country. It's having radio broadcasting over the Internet. So this station can be streamed, but your listeners can listen to thousands of stations now. You don't actually need over-the-air spectrum, which may be much more valuable for other technological uses. You don't really need it anymore for over-the-air broadcasting. You can get much more varied content, much freer content, if you have more high-powered ways to reach people through more powerful national wireless broadband kinds of services.
Yeah.
So as long as you have more capacity to flow information, you can have more voices being heard.
All right, let's talk with someone else. So this is also someone in Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Boy, this is fascinating. I called in intending to talk about patents, but it turns out that I actually own and run a wireless internet service provider here in Champaign-Urbana.
This is great.
So this is...
You're the future.
The conversation has turned to a very a topic that's very close to my heart. But I am surprised to hear some of the things that you say, because, for example, if you take Japan as an example, they do have a great wireless broadband infrastructure there. But it's not because they have more airwaves in use. In fact, in a lot of the spectrum areas, they're using less bandwidth than we are. It's, as far as I can tell, mostly because the density of the population is sufficient to support a much, much more in-depth deployment. Whereas here in the U.S., you have that in Manhattan, but you don't have that in 90% of the rest of the country, 99% of the rest of the country. There's a lot more that I'd like to ask about this. If you could, am I wrong about that, or is that?
What's going to quickly happen, and this is what always happens when we talk about telecom. I usually don't bring it up. One of the listeners did, because it gets into what's called MIGO discussions. My eyes glaze over. And this is the chapter in the book where I put it towards the back of the book because I tend to lose readers, and I don't want to lose listeners. So it quickly gets very technical. So Japan does have greater density.
Let's recast the question in the terms that you've been using in this conversation. You say that 90% of our airwaves are unused. Now, first of all, it's the electromagnetic spectrum is gigantic.
I'm talking about prime spectrum, so from 300 to 300 megahertz to 3 gigahertz. So the main spectrum that's useful for wireless transmissions, for data transmission, for voice transmission of various sorts, ranges from about 300 up to about 3 gigahertz.
And so how much is in use in Japan or one of these
I don't have that number directly in front of me, so that's a good question, and I will go look it up, but I won't look it up while I'm talking to you. The number, I believe, is higher, and the density is higher, but mostly what they have is greater ability to create basically wider pipes. So in this country, we only have three networks that are able to support what's called 3G transmission, high-speed wireless broadband, Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint. Even the fourth largest carrier in this country, T-Mobile, is only now beginning to get the spectrum it needs for it to have a 3G network. Japan is already well onto 4G networks. Even in Manhattan, which is the highest density in the United States, we don't have that sort of high-speed capacity yet. So even in the densest parts of the United States, we haven't yet gotten to what's already standard throughout Japan.
Okay, and your contention is that that's because the companies can't buy up the spectrum?
That's the main reason, is that it's, for example, we just had a big wireless spectrum auction a few months ago, this spring.
Right.
And we had another big one 2 years ago, the advanced wireless spectrum in 2006. And in the 2006 auction, that was when T-Mobile was finally able to buy the spectrum it needs to have to develop its 3G network. But the cost of that development is in the tens of billions of dollars, and they still haven't gotten it online. Partly it's because the spectrum that was available wasn't particularly good spectrum. It was fairly high up in the 2 gigahertz range. The really good spectrum, the sort of beachfront spectrum, in this country is analog TV spectrum that the TV broadcasters have sat on for the last several decades and haven't been willing to give back to the public. That spectrum could support really high-capacity transmission, but we haven't been able to get there. Again, I feel like as I'm talking, we're losing listeners because this gets technical very quickly. But the basic point is the same, which is what we have is a system for spectrum ownership in this country, like a system of patent ownership, like a system of land ownership, all of which have this hidden feature, which is it's easy to create too many fragmented owners and really hard to put together resources for next-generation technology.
So how does Japan auction or mediate its spectrum for one of these countries?
They basically keep more public control, and they license it in larger chunks and larger adjacent chunks, so you can have more capacity flowing through.
I see.
And they also license it at a national level. In this country, for example, when we first created cellular licenses, we created it in 734 geographic areas. So we initially created a cellular system where it was impossible to have a national carrier because you started off with 734 carriers. It took about a decade for us to get the first national carriers after we first licensed spectrum. So it's just a matter of choices. One of the things about gridlock is that every gridlock example in the book is a set of choices that we make about how to structure the resources that we value the most. So in this country, we structured it, we had in the front of our minds the concerns that David was raising about keeping deconcentrating ownership to have more voices. So we kept that first in our mind. So we created 734 little wireless carriers. And that was great for deconcentration, but terrible for national service. It's extremely expensive and slow in this country for us even to get the beginnings of decent national wireless coverage.
But now we do, and it's still been years since they've...
Well, now we do, but it's still terrible.
They've sat on it.
Now we do have national coverage, but it's still comparatively slow to the rest of the world. And the reason it's comparatively slow is that the national pipes that we have are small pipes. They only can carry a very limited amount of data on them. They're partly because they're for technological reasons and partly for regulatory reasons.
Okay.
All right.
I'll let other...
All right. Well, I thank you for the questions.
Thank you.
My guest this morning is Michael Heller. He is professor of real estate law at Columbia Law School and is one of the country's leading authorities on property. And if you're interested in reading more on this subject, look for his book, The Gridlock Economy. The subtitle is How Too Much Ownership Wrecks Markets, Stops Innovation, and Costs Lives. It's published by Basic Books. And we have another caller here in Sullivan. There next. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah. I think there's one thing you're kind of missing on private property as far as land ownership. If you do not go to the courthouse and pay your yearly tithe in taxes, in 1 year's time or perhaps less, it is sold at public auction and you lose your farm or business or home or whatever. I mean, I hate to say it, but I don't believe there's any private ownership in this country. You have a mere yearly lease, but if you do not pay your tax, you're done for.
Well, that's an interesting comment.
It is.
You should be a law student, because that's exactly the kind of question that law students debate to a large extent. Like, what ultimately is the difference between a lease and ownership? And it's always subtle, because in every system in the world where you have land ownership, you also have land taxation of some sort. It's impossible. You have to have some mechanism to pay for the public values that are associated with land. In this country, you can't legally create ownership of land that doesn't front on some public access. So you can't have private ownership completely cut off from any road or waterway or so on legally. And that's true in most countries. And the reason we do that is because the value of land, the private value we have as owners, comes largely from its relationship to other pieces of land, from the ability to get on it and off it and to do things on it. And to do any of that, you need some link to something public, to a road. So private ownership necessarily implies some, it's in some matrix always of public ownership as well. And that public ownership has to get paid for, and the way that we do it is through taxation. So even in the most robust private property systems in the world, like the United States, you always have some form of taxation. So you can say that the taxation, in some sense, takes away from your ownership, but I would frame it a little bit differently. I would say that that's an intrinsic part of what it means to be a private owner anywhere in the world, anywhere in the world, even in the most intense free market systems that we've ever devised, always have some element of taxation. And taxation is a part of what provides the value, the private value, to private owners in their private land. So I'm not disagreeing with you, I think, so much as saying that ownership is always, it's always complicated. We always create ownership to further certain public values and certain private values and private autonomy, private liberty. And that's a complicated balance everywhere. So in the book, I talk about the role of taxation in part, sometimes as a tool for fixing gridlock, which it can occasionally be.
You know, I understand that, but I still think, you know, shall we say the majority of people now will say basically own a mortgage their home, and, you know, I just think it's unique that you cannot own a thing in this country because it's just like inheritance tax. In 2011, it goes back to $1 million and 55% tax rate. And the way farm values are now, you know, land values are selling. I mean, it only takes a couple hundred acres or 250 acres, and bingo, here's the $1 million level, and everything after that is, we'll say, 40% tax.
Yeah, rate. No, I agree with you. The estate tax is a great topic, not necessarily for this interview, because I'm not a... I'm happy to spend an hour talking about it with you, but I'm not sure how, unless we can link it back to the gridlock discussion, I think we should have this as a separate discussion, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments of the caller. And I also need to jump in here just because I want people to know that we've got just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. And if you'd like to join in, we'd certainly be happy to have questions from folks who are listening. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to get back to the very first example that you gave. You have talked a little bit about solutions to some of the dimensions of this. The first story you told was the fact that you had talked with somebody who worked for a pharmaceutical company. He said they had developed a treatment that they thought would be very good for Alzheimer's disease, but they couldn't develop it because to do so, they would have to have access to a whole bunch of patents. And any of the people holding those patents could say to them, well, okay, fine. You want to use this? It's going to cost you some serious money. And in fact, some of them said prevented even that from happening. So how do you deal with a situation like that?
Well, this is a problem that really many of the problems in the book are problems that come up in everyday life. So when your brother and sister and you inherit your parents' house, you can easily work it out, or that's often a case where you have gridlock. And so some of the problems, some of the solutions have to do with things that people can do in their own lives. But the problem of drug patents, relatively few of us are drug patent lawyers or drug makers, at least in the sense that I mean. So for that type of problem, we do need a different kind of solution, and there it's legislative and particularly congressional. So the main role that we play as citizens in fixing drug patent gridlock is to be advocates, is to be talking with the representatives about the problem of gridlock and getting them to fix it. So to fix there is patent reform legislation that's been on the Hill for the last couple of years and keeps getting killed. There's a bill designed to fix patent gridlock that was introduced in part because of the problems that I'm raising. It's introduced as a bipartisan bill by Leahy for Democrats and Orrin Hatch for the Republicans, and they've been shepherding it through the Senate and the House for the last couple of years, and every year it keeps getting killed. And it keeps getting killed because the drug makers won't reach agreement with the rest of high-tech America, the telecoms and banks and so on, and software makers and semiconductor makers that need patent reform to fix gridlock in their industries. And the reason drug makers won't go along is that they want very strong patent protection to protect themselves against generic drug makers who take all their profits when the patents end. So they're willing to give up the possibility of inventing new drugs in order to protect their existing pipeline that's very profitable for a drug that they already have. So what we really need, and what if the next president wants to be an innovation president, either McCain or Obama, if they're going to be the innovation president, they have to give a nudge to these drug makers and the rest of high-tech America to get them to work out a deal. And this is an area where it really is just a matter of reaching a deal between finding some way to protect drug makers' ability to make a profit and having them step out of the way so that the rest of high-tech America can get the patent reform we all need for next-generation investment. And the deal almost got made this spring. They came close, but then it fell apart in June, and the bill died again. So the next president, this is one of the big tasks for the next president, is to recognize and fix the problem of gridlock. It's basically nudge, Congress is doing its part here, but to nudge the drug makers and biotech companies to figure out a way that they can get fairly compensated and get out of the way of what the rest of us need. And there are some solutions here. To give you a little bit, we can change the way that the damages formulas work in litigation. We can change the venue, the location where people are suing. We can change. There's a whole list of fairly small and technical changes that we can make that would go a long way towards fixing gridlock in the drug area.
All right. Let's talk with some other listeners. Next is someone in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if the guest could discuss if private pharmaceutical companies or research companies have been licensing segments of the human genome and what that might do for this whole process. So,
that's a great question. And the way we used to discover drugs in this country is basic science was done in universities like the University of Illinois. And the results were paid for by the government or paid for by universities, and they were put into the public domain. So if you wanted to have a pill in a bottle that treated something and you needed access to hundreds of pieces of genetic information, for example, all of that information would be available to you free to assemble into the drugs that you needed. About 30 years ago, as part of this shift towards a new style of innovation, we changed the patent law to allow basic science in this country to be patented, to allow living organisms to be patented. So it became possible to patent certain types of mice that you develop, or crops that you develop, or the genome. So it became possible to patent fragments of the gene. And indeed, in the last 30 years, we now have over 40,000 DNA-related patents. So there's been an explosion of patenting of the basic stuff of life. And that's a very controversial moral and ethical dilemma that people have talked about. Should we be able to patent life? The upside of having patenting is that we've had the biotech revolution. We've had tens of billions of dollars go into discovering much, much more basic stuff about how life works. That's the upside. The downside is that the drugs that actually treat human disease haven't been coming out of the pipeline nearly as fast. So we've had much, much more patenting of basic science, but much, much fewer drugs that actually treat disease. I call this the drug discovery gap. And the reason for this drug discovery gap is patent gridlock. Is the problem that if you're a drug maker today and you walk into an auditorium and there's 100 people, each with their patent on their lap, you have to negotiate with every single one of those patent holders. And if you miss even one, you can be sued and your drug can be taken off the market, or you can have damages that exceed your profits. So knowing that it's impossible to assemble all the patents that you need, drug makers don't go after these kinds of really high-stakes drugs that can change the course of human disease. They go after, for example, modifications of existing drugs as to which they already own the patent rights. So it's a new style of innovation in the drug area because we have a new style of ownership just in the last 30 years about what's patentable. We changed what's patentable. We got some benefits, but we also had some hidden costs. So again, this sounds fairly technical. I hope if you pick up the book, you'll see I write about this in a very non-technical way. I really wrote this book for people who like, if you liked Freakonomics or The Tipping Point, books like that, this is the same style of read. The examples aren't technical. You don't have to worry about spectrum licensing or the details of patent law. If you want them, they're in there. But most of my examples are things like rap music, airport delays, things that really, I hope, reach every one of us in a more immediate way.
Well, I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go next talk with someone in Paris. That is Paris, Illinois. Line number four. Hello.
Yes. Concerning the pharmaceuticals, how about extending the patent for those medicines that are evidence-based improvements from past treatments?
Well, that's a great question. So what you're getting into now is some of the details of how we strike this deal. And I'm all in favor of that. That what the next president needs to do is to get the pharmaceutical industry, the big pharma, biotech industry, bio, together with the their competitors in other areas, the semiconductors, software, and so on, and work out a deal. So we can work out a deal that, for example, extends patents in certain areas, but in exchange for making it easier to assemble patents at the upstream part. So make it easier to assemble patents initially to create new drugs, but give more reward later on in exchange for that. That's a fine solution. That's exactly the kind of creative solutions that we can come up with for fixing gridlock.
Well,
but you have to see that there is a problem with gridlock before you can begin to have that kind of discussion.
Well, at the same time, if another product comes out that is not an improvement, then they have a shorter patent.
Right.
That way you stimulate evidence-based medicine that is going to...
Right. Well, there's a version of this already in place in the patenting process with in terms of the approval process for drug applications, where whether it's a major, whether it's a priority or not a priority approval depends in part on how much of an advance the new drug is over the existing drugs. And drugs that are a larger step of improvement today get a much more expedited, much faster form of approval through the FDA. So it doesn't quite go extending the length of the patent, but the current system extends the effective length of the patent because you get faster approval, so you can sell your drug for longer for drugs that are more of a step of improvement over the existing drugs. So, but your suggestion is to extend the patent as well, and that's a reasonable suggestion, but we should make that as part of a grand deal, just like we, whenever we do these big patent reforms or any kind of big legal reform, it's usually a deal among the various players who's getting helped and who's getting hurt. But what I'm trying to do here is throw into the discussion, hey, as you're cutting these deals, think about the gridlock problem. Think about how we can address it in our own lives. Think about how we can get those drugs that we need.
Well, in addition to that, if you would allow the drug companies then to do studies to prove their efficacy later on after the patent has been approved for a normal patent, mm-hmm. and they find out that they are more efficacious and safer, then they can get maybe a year or 2 year extension of their patent because
right.
they've actually done the studies to prove their efficacy.
We've had versions of this. We've had versions of that kind of a deal before in the drug area. When we passed the bill called Hatch-Waxman in the 80s, and that also allowed that gave certain kinds of additional protection for drugs that met certain criteria, like the ones that you're saying. So yes, the answer is yes, absolutely. We can cut a deal with drug makers. There's a cost to that deal, which is that the drugs stay more expensive for a longer period of time, and that's a big social cost. People who need the drugs can't get access to them. But if that's what it takes in order to create more and better drugs initially, that may be a trade-off that's worth making. But that trade-off is exactly the kind of trade-off that Congress is constitutionally charged with making. The U.S. Constitution tells Congress, you have to make these decisions as between having fewer drugs that are maybe less expensive or more drugs that are maybe more expensive. That's a congressional job, and Congress last did that job in a thoroughgoing way in 1952, before we even knew about DNA. It's time to do that again. There's a bipartisan bill that we keep trying to do it, but it keeps being killed by gridlock. Spot gridlock. Once we spot gridlock, we can begin to talk about gridlock like we're doing on this show. And once we talk about it, I hope the next step is that we can actually fix it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
It would just real quickly here, I guess it was my understanding that within the last couple of years, there has been a decision before the Supreme Court that the ultimate outcome was to make it more difficult to get a patent?
Yes. So there have the Supreme Court, after many, many years of inaction in this area, they simply refused to take cases dealing with patents for a generation, and they let all of patent law be decided by a second-level court that specializes in it. And that second-level court, because all it does is deal with patents, was extremely pro-patent. And that was part of what got us into this gridlock mess in the patent area. The Supreme Court finally said, whoa, this has gone way too far. The Supreme Court began to understand the cost of gridlock, and there have been a number of Supreme Court decisions just in the last couple of years that have made it harder to get patents initially. You have to have more of an inventive step. You have to do more before we grant you a patent monopoly for 20 years. And they've also made it harder for people who have patents, for some patent troll, somebody who has a small patent that doesn't even practice in the area, made it harder for them to shut down companies that come up with some big invention through what's called an injunction, basically taking the product off the market. So the Supreme Court has begun to do its job and supervise the second-level courts and say, hey, hold on a second, we need some balance here. Patents are good, private ownership is good, but only up to a point. Beyond that point, we get gridlock. And the Supreme Court has started to find that balance, but the Supreme Court can only interpret the law as it is on the books. And the law on the books is still bad law. It's law from the 1950s. So the Supreme Court can help, and it's done a little bit in the last few years, but really what we need in this area is citizen activism and congressional action and maybe some presidential leadership.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. If you're interested in reading more on this subject, you look for the book that we have mentioned. The title is The Gridlock Economy, How Too Much Ownership Wrecks Markets, Stops Innovation, and Costs Lives. It's published by Basic Books by our guest Michael Heller. He is professor of real estate law at Columbia Law School. And Professor Heller, thank you very much.
Totally a pleasure to be here. Thank you.